前面已经站不准稳了，我们现在马上来看到剧情。我们包括呢摄影棚的上方都有一些器材呢正在往下掉。地震速报已经告诉我们了，在7:58左右呢发生的有感地震，这是非常有感的，而且呢震央看起来是在
The moment a 7.4 magnitude earthquake struck during a live news broadcast in Taiwan this morning. Studio lights swung wildly and clanged overhead as the presenter steadied herself on the set behind her. She kept reporting the news. It is the most powerful earthquake the island has seen in 25 years. We're still learning the full extent of the damage, but several buildings collapsed and the shaking triggered multiple landslides near the epicenter. However, Taiwan's strict building codes and measures put in place after a 1999 earthquake that was much more devastating will likely prevent this tremor from being much worse than it could have been. So far, 9 people have died, more than 1,000 have been injured. Joining me to talk about this now is Dr. Lucy Jones, a seismologist and the founder of the Dr. Lucy Jones Center for Science and Society. Welcome back to the show, Lucy.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you actually lived in Taiwan for a number of years. You're an Angeleno now, of course. So what did you think when you heard about this earthquake this morning?
Well, the first thing I thought is always, exactly where is it? And it's on the east coast of Taiwan, and it's running through a town of Hualien, which I've visited a few times. But it's well away from the main population centers, and that's one of the reasons it's not going to be much worse. Hualien received extreme shaking, a lot of landslides. It's a very mountainous region. But Taipei and Taichung, the big cities, were mostly spared.
So is that mostly a question of luck, then, that there weren't more casualties?
It's one of the factors. You know, when you think about how much damage is there, what is it going to be? You need to think of really four things. Magnitude tells you how much energy is released, but that doesn't tell you what you got. You need to include your distance from that energy source to know what you personally received. You also need to understand the soils that where you are and whether or not they can amplify that shaking. And then the last factor is what are the building codes? What are the measures that have been put to place to build to resist earthquakes? And in this case, the big changes since 1999 made a big difference for newer buildings. But also then, you know, the relatively limited population that was directly on top of it. I think when you look and you'll see that all of the downed buildings are in that town of Hualien.
Mm-hmm. And when you mentioned 1999, that was the worst quake that Taiwan, modern Taiwan, had experienced. It was a 7.7 on the magnitude scale, 2,400 deaths, 100,000 people injured, thousands of buildings destroyed. And so what did they put in place after that earthquake?
Well, there's the fundamental thing of what do you want your buildings to achieve and what do you do to enforce that? So they put in stronger codes saying we want to be building to have our buildings survive the event. And then also, you know, I think they did some of reevaluating of the systems of how they enforce the building codes, because that's usually where many of the problems lie. Let's put it that way. The other big issue is that the standard building code, the international building code, doesn't ask that your buildings be usable. They only ask that they not kill you.
Hmm.
So we intentionally build buildings that are barely strong enough to not fully collapse, accepting that they're going to be a total financial loss to save about 1% on the cost of construction up front.
That's what we do here in the United States, in California,
yeah.
Is what you're saying?
Yeah. And I'm not sure where Taiwan has gone. They have gone towards stronger codes. I don't know how far they've gone towards really what we call functional recovery. Building so that you can recover the function of the building.
Well, to save on 1% of construction costs, that can be a lot, right? If you're building a major skyscraper.
It can be. In the long run, you save money by building to withstand, building to be recovering. And the estimates are that you save about $4 for every extra dollar you spend at the beginning to achieve functional recovery.
I see. Okay. So I guess the question is, what do we learn from this? We here in Los Angeles and in all of California, we are also on the Ring of Fire. So when we look at this earthquake in Taiwan, what should we take away from it?
Well, remember that it's been less than 24 hours, so we haven't learned that much yet,
yeah.
Right? We really do need to get more in detailed analyses. My superficial look here at the very beginning One thing I notice is that the buildings that act, the pictures I've seen of buildings that actually failed have what are called soft first stories. They were built in a way such that the first floor had big openings, you know, probably for a retail store, but we do it here for parking. And that when the first floor is weaker, it fails during the earthquake, and the, you know, that you can't keep a building up that way. Most of these seem to be that. It's a big problem here in California. We haven't allowed those to be built in a while, but we have a lot of older structures that way. Several cities, including Los Angeles, Santa Monica, West Hollywood, Pasadena, and Beverly Hills, those are the big Southern California ones, have put in what we say mandatory retrofit, forcing the owners of such buildings to strengthen that first floor so that we don't get this type of failure. But that means most of the cities of Southern California have not done that yet. So there's one is a real example of where that makes a difference. I think the other thing we can see is that even though it didn't have much any damage in Taipei, we can see that it had substantially stronger shaking than other areas at the same sort of distance. And that's probably what we call a basin amplification effect. That Taipei sits just like Los Angeles in a big bowl of sediment. And that sediment amplifies shaking during the earthquake, just like when you know, knock a bowl of Jell-O, the Jell-O will slop around even though the bowl is sitting still. And so it wasn't in, this was far enough away, it wasn't causing lots of damage in Taipei, but we have exactly that same problem here. And when we have the earthquake that's on, say, the Santa Monica Fault or the Hollywood Fault or any of the ones within the basin, we're going to see a lot more shaking because of that basin amplification.
And what effect does an earthquake on the other side of the Ring of Fire in Taiwan, would it have any effect on the significance or any kind of future earthquake here on
No.
this side?
We all want to think it. It's interesting how many people try to find that relationship, but we don't see any triggering across the basin. And there's nothing that like goes down the faults. We only see it the impact of one earthquake on another dies off with distance. So aftershocks are mostly really close to the fault, and you see a slight increase out to, you know, a couple hundred miles around this earthquake, but no farther than that.
So it's not only that they have strict building codes now implemented since that quake in 1999 in Taiwan. They also have very vigorous public education campaigns. They have a strong seismological network. How do we compare with those kinds of preparations? Like, do we have a good warning system, an early warning system? Do we have fairly okay? I mean, we have the Great Shakeout, public education campaigns.
All right. So on the warning system, you know, it's all based on the same principle, and it's how many stations you put in, but also how you get that information out. I was impressed with that the TV broadcast that we've seen where,
Yeah,
you know,
that we played at
it
the
comes
top.
up on the TV before the shaking. The USGS and its partners in the seismic networks produce that signal that says this is it's coming. I don't know that we have any TV stations that are set up to receive it and broadcast it during broadcasts. And you know, that's something that the government, the USGS, says, well, that's not our job. That's for an individual station. And I don't think we've really followed through on that as much as we could or should.
Okay, so we could have that. And also, but we also have warning systems on our phones that we can sign up for too.
Right. And yeah, so they work in different ways. Again, the USGS has left that to the phone operators. So Android makes it native to the system. iPhone, you have to get a separate app that adds a couple seconds to the communication process, which has some impact. But yes, we do have them individually. But the phone ones are always going to take longer than anything that goes through the internet. That's one of the reasons that the TV or you know, a radio station, does KCRW receive that signal through the internet and broadcast it when it comes through? I don't
I
think so.
don't know. I don't think so. I have not heard that. So
And that would be a way in which we could significantly increase the speed at which quite a few people get
right. Okay. That is something to look into if the bosses are listening
it.
right now. Okay. So we are overdue. We talk about this all the time with you. So any minute now, any not to be a
Oh, right.
scaremonger, but
You'll notice I never say overdue
okay.
because fundamentally the process is random in time. So we know the rate at which they happen. We know we have to average three magnitude fives in Southern California every year. And recently, the last 20 years or so, we haven't had so many. That doesn't mean we're going to have to get a bunch more. It just means that the rate is a bit variable. But the exact time of any one doesn't seem to depend very much on when the last one was. So that's the reason I avoid calling it overdue. That said, we on the long-term average, we have a magnitude 7 in Southern California on average every 10 to 15 years. Mm-hmm. Well, in fact, we had one in 2019. We had one in 1999. Both of them were out in the desert. When they come along in the city, it's going to be a very different picture.
Okay. Dr. Lucy Jones, seismologist and founder of the Dr. Lucy Jones Center for Science and Society. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, who is the Los Angeles billionaire who volunteered to pay Donald Trump's $175 million bond? Donald Hanke made his money in the subprime loan business. Also, the organizers of a new Los Angeles Film Festival will be here, and that is next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Former President Donald Trump posted a $175 million bond this week. It gives him time to appeal a New York civil court ruling that found he inflated his net worth and the value of his assets to deceive lenders. The number had been a lot higher. Trump was on the hook for more than twice that before a court lowered the amount. But he still had trouble coming up with the money until a Southern California auto lending tycoon named Don Hanke came to Trump's rescue. Michael Cranish is a national political investigative reporter who profiled Hanke for The Washington Post. Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, tell us more about him, Don Hanke, and how he made all his money.
Well, Mr. Hanke is a 80-year-old, works in Los Angeles, lives in Malibu. He once owned, or maybe he still does own, the estate called Xanadu of Olivia Newton-John, the singer. Made a lot of money. Forbes magazine, I believe, put his net worth at $7.4 billion, boy. So he's not just a billionaire, but a multi-billionaire. And he has been a Republican and a supporter of former President Trump. The backstory here is that President Trump needed more than $400 million to post a bond in the case you just mentioned. Then that was reached $175 million. Trump said he had the money to do that, the cash to do that. But Mr. Hanke came along and he said, well, we are in the business of providing this. And basically, Trump put up the $175 million cash to back this. And Hanke's company basically put up the bond. Hanke gets a fee out of this. He won't disclose the amount. Trump gets to collect interest on the money he otherwise would have put up to the court. So it's Trump
so it's
wins
a win-win.
In that way. Yeah, in that way. I mean, you know, Trump was having trouble finding companies that wanted to do this.
Yeah.
If you recall, after January 6th, a number of Trump's biggest lenders basically cut ties to him. So Trump was having trouble getting money, and there were stories about the precarious financial position that he was in. A different Southern California entity, a bank called Axos Bank in La Jolla, loaned Trump $225 million in 2022, and that got him out of the fix he was in at that time with some banks cutting ties. And the same gentleman, Don Hanke, is the largest individual non-institutional shareholder of that bank, Axos Bank. I talked to Mr. Hanke yesterday. He told me he wasn't aware that Axos had made those loans. But it certainly is worth noting, and I did in the story. Anyway, Mr. Hanke made a lot of his fortune making these high interest rate loans to people with poor credit who wanted to buy autos. Mm. Many, many thousands of loans to individuals who couldn't get regular loans at, say, 3-4%. He explained in a story that I cited that he could charge an individual perhaps 20%, 24% interest rate for a loan because individual couldn't get credit. For those individuals, you know, that could be helpful because they could get loans elsewhere. That's a lot of money to have to pay, though, in interest, obviously. So, and I mentioned in the story that there were some questions about that.
Right. He's been fined by federal authorities, right? For
Companies.
Or he personally, but his company. So,
right.
So would he charge that much to Donald Trump? Likely not in terms of interest.
20%. No, I asked him. It's not a matter of interest. It's a matter of, in this case, a fee.
Oh, okay.
So I asked him, okay, you're putting up $175 million. What is the fee? He declined to disclose that other than to say it was, by his definition, a, quote, modest fee. So, I don't know what a multi-billionaire's definition of modest is. So I simply said in the story, you know, that he wouldn't disclose what that meant. But Trump is paying him a fee. It's a business for him. And given that Trump's putting up all cash of the same amount of the bond, Hanke, you know, feels like it's pretty safe investment here to do this.
Well, I don't know if it's a safe investment because Trump is notorious for not paying back his creditors or not paying contractors, you know, and suing them instead. And so it seems like a little bit of a risky bet to loan Donald Trump money.
It was a very, very valid question. I co-authored the Post biography several years ago called Trump Revealed, in which we talked at length about how Trump had filed for 6 corporate bankruptcies, which meant people wouldn't get, you know, all the money that they loaned him. There's many instances of contractors saying they were stiffed and so forth. So I asked the same question a couple of years ago regarding the loans a couple of years ago from Axos Bank, interviewed the president there last year, asked him that exact question. And he said, basically, he loaned money, for example, $100 million on Trump Tower. Well, how are you sure you're going to get that $100 million back? And he said, you know, this loan is as solid, I'm paraphrasing, as solid as can be. And that he would, felt absolutely certain he could get his money back, that he wasn't making a deal as a favor. He was doing it as a business matter when other banks, you know, did not want to step in. So I asked the same question to Mr. Hanke, and he said Trump put up $175 million cash. That is, you know, a one for one. Basically, sometimes I guess when you do a bond and you get a company to do it for you, it might be a percentage that the person's putting up. In this case, Hank, I asked him specifically, are you getting 100% of the $175 million put up by Trump? And he said yes. So that's why he felt satisfied that he would be able to get repayment, whereas others have not.
Is there anything else he might want from Trump should Donald Trump win re-election?
Well, it's a good question. You know, I think any time that there is an individual who's responsible for financially helping out someone who could be president, it's inevitable that people will look at, is anything being done for that person? You know, we're casting forward into the future here. Mr. Hanke runs a number of businesses in Southern California. So it's inevitable that some of those might come under some kind of federal purview, scrutiny, regulation. So, you know, those kind of questions will be asked. Same question for Axos Bank in La Jolla. You know, I asked about that. And, you know, it's inevitable that people might look and say, you know, are you doing him an ineffective favor? You can't give that money directly to his campaign, but you're helping him out, maybe even in a bigger way by doing this. So it's questions that if Trump is reelected, that Mr. Hanke and his companies might face.
Right. Because as you said, and as we just discussed, he already has been fined for some of his business practices, or rather his companies have been fined for his business practices.
His companies were fined. Mm-hmm. This was an action by in the later days of the Obama administration. There was a $41 million basically that had to be provided in relief to people who had borrowed from Hanke's companies, and another $4 million in a fine. I asked Hanke about that. He said it was, these were loans put through some kind of process that we call it an electronic process. Didn't think his companies did anything wrong, but the bottom line is the companies did have to pay, you know, those amounts.
So as you say, he's the owner of Xanadu, Olivia Newton-John's former residence. And he's also an investor in what's called The One, which is an enormous, extravagant mansion in Bel Air that's having trouble finding a buyer. I think it was on the market for $500 million. I think that price has now been slashed in half or so, but still they haven't found a buyer. And Hanke is on the hook for, I think, $100 million. So that seems kind of also a risky bet. So for someone who has made so much money being very hard-nosed about loaning to poor people, it seems like he's willing to make some very extravagant loans to wealthier people.
I didn't mention the one in my story because I didn't have all the information on it yesterday and didn't want to get into something that I didn't have all the info on. I did look up that. I don't know today's current status of those debts. I know that there had been an investment, and I saw quoted, I believe it was in a Los Angeles Times story, that, you know, he would be in line to be get his repayment. But, you know, I just want to be clear to the listeners, I haven't done all the reporting that I would put into a story on that. I did see the LA Times had done a story on what was called the one, and your listeners probably know a lot more about that than I do, but it certainly looked intriguing.
Yeah. Okay.
Say the least.
Fantastic. All right. Well, this has been fascinating to go into this detail about this particular, I guess, friend. They haven't even spoken, right? He and Trump, they're not exactly friends.
He told me, when I talked to Mr. Hanke yesterday, I had two conversations with him. He said that he has never spoken as of yesterday to Donald Trump, but that after this deal was consummated yesterday morning, Trump's son, Eric, who basically runs the Trump Organization, called him up and thanked him for posting this bond.
Okay. It's the least you could do. Okay. Michael Cranish, who wrote about Don Hanke with co-author Jonathan O'Connell in The Washington Post. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, tomorrow on Press Play, we will have your weekend movie review, so tune in for that. Coming up next today, a film festival for Los Angeles that seeks to promote indie and art films.
LA now has a point where there's a great movie to see every night all over the city. And for us, this felt like, you know, the ideal moment to launch a festival for movies that are outside of the commercial mainstream.
That story coming up next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. There's Toronto, there's Berlin, there's New York, and on and on. Lots of great cities have great film festivals. Now, LA is trying to start a new one. This week is the debut of the Los Angeles Festival of Movies. The organizers hope to succeed where past LA film festivals have not. I'm joined now by the organizers, Micah Gottlieb and Sarah Winshall. Welcome to Press Play, both of you. And congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Yeah. So this is quite an undertaking. Tell us a little bit more about what this festival is. And let's begin with you, Sarah.
Well, I think we're trying to be a place where people in LA who love movies can come out and watch a lot of independent and exciting new experimental films.
And are they new, like they haven't been seen anywhere else before?
Some are brand new world premiere, but mm-hmm. a lot of the films that we're playing are coming out of Sundance. We aren't a marketplace as much, though today we did learn that one of the films did get a distribution deal out of our festival. So who knows what could happen. But definitely every single film that's in our festival has not played in Los Angeles yet.
Mm. Talk a little bit about the title, how you came up with it, the Los Angeles Festival of Movies. It's not a film festival. It's a movie festival. Is there a difference?
I mean, I think for us, it's a little bit tongue in cheek. We're trying to make sure that people know that we're not taking ourselves too seriously. A film festival has a sort of pre-existing reputation. We think we know already what those are. The Los Angeles Festival of Movies is similar to a festival of books or a festival of music. We're trying to present movies to an audience.
And so if you could describe it in, I guess, a log line, because we are in Hollywood or Hollywood adjacent. How would you describe it? The festival is movies you'll see about what?
I would say that our lineup runs the gamut of coming of age movies, experimental film, DIY comedies, personal documentaries, and we also have a TV show in the lineup. I think that that's part of what we're trying to show is that, you know, independent film is a lot of different things. It's not static. It's something that I think can, you know, always be defined by risk and personal expression. And, you know, I think that for us, you know, what our goal is if we're able to get people to take chances on movies that they've never heard of before and movies that maybe challenge some notions of what they feel movies should be, then I think we're doing our jobs. I think that, you know, people are really hungry to discover new films and filmmakers. And, you know, that's what we're hoping to do.
Got it. Got it. And so, Micah, how did you choose the films that you're showing?
So we were interested in showcasing what we feel to be, you know, the past and present landscape of independent cinema. And we were specifically interested in showing movies that, for whatever reason, may or may not show in LA, or if they do come to LA, they might not get the attention or the platform that we feel they deserve. So our lineup is a selection of movies that have played at a number of the spring festivals like Sundance, South by Southwest, Rotterdam, as well as some movies that maybe came out last year, played at festivals last year that haven't yet had their LA premiere yet. Also, we're showing a number of restoration premieres of older independent films that we feel really deserve a second look. So ultimately, we wanted to keep it eclectic and fun and hopefully provide something for everyone.
Give us some examples of what you're showing.
So our opening night movie is a film by a director named Jane Schoenbrunn. It's called I Saw the TV Glow. And this is a new teen movie that has, you know, a lot of really heavy emotions writ large. There's almost kind of a mournful and abstract quality to it, which I think is really rare to see in teen movies. And I think that that's why this movie had such a kind of glowing response at Sundance. So for us, you know, this is the kind of independent film that we champion, given just that it takes really big swings. And I think it's a movie that people will be talking about for a long time. And on the restoration side, I'm really proud that we're premiering the new 4K restoration of a film by Chantal Ackerman, the great Belgian director. Mm-hmm. It's a film called Toute une Nuit, or All Night Long. And it's a movie that takes place over one long night in Brussels. A number of people who are, you know, lonely hearts who are sort of seeking romance. And it's kind of an episodic, you know, cinematic poem about the fleeting nature of romance and the kind of disappointment that can come through. And I feel like no one is better than framing life's disappointments than Chantal Ackerman was. So extremely happy to have that. And we also have two other really distinctive movies about teenagers in the festival. I mentioned I Saw the TV Glow. Really excited about Gasoline Rainbow, which is a new film by the Ross Brothers. They're filmmakers who are mainly known for their documentaries, but they've made something that's a bit more of a hybrid. It's kind of a road trip movie about a group of high school kids who are kind of going for one last ride before graduation. And we also have another acclaimed film from Sundance called A Good One, which is directed by India Donaldson. And these are, you know, all of these are films that for us really take dramatic risks and are pushing the boundaries of the form in search of kind of a larger emotional truth.
Well, so that's a good segue into who you are and how you got involved in this. And what is your background in film, and why are you interested in presenting these films that, as you say, push boundaries or are, you know, maybe more difficult than your average AMC movie fare?
Sure. So I'm from Los Angeles, but I lived and worked in New York City for a number of years, working in the independent film distribution and exhibition landscape. And, you know, coming to Los Angeles, I came to realize that this is a city that's so defined by the commercial film industry, which is natural given that this is where Hollywood is. But I think that as a result of that, independent and art house cinema often gets sidelined or forgotten about. I think that, you know, in cities like New York, you have institutions like Lincoln Center, MoMA, Anthology Film Archives that, you know, have been devoted to independent art house cinema in the broadest sense, and sometimes feel a bit more connected to the international film and art landscape than to Hollywood. And by contrast, the landscape of LA has felt more scattered and heterogeneous. But I think that that has really changed since COVID. You know, you have all of these new venues and initiatives that have opened, like Vidiot's and Eagle Rock. You have the Academy Museum, the renovated Egyptian Theater. And also, you know, any night of the week, if you go to the Los Feliz 3, which is programmed by the American Cinematheque, you see packed houses for a huge variety of revivals as well as new movies. And so LA now has a point where there's a great movie to see every night all over the city. And for us, this felt like, you know, the ideal moment to launch a festival for movies that are outside of the commercial mainstream.
And what about you, Sarah? How did you get involved in this?
I've always been interested in film since I was little. I went to college and did film studies, and I did my master's in film studies as well, and worked, you know, at a video store in New York. And I was sort of figuring out my place in the film world for a long time, and ultimately ended up producing several extremely independent films. But when I met Micah and got introduced to the mezzanine series that he runs year round, I was really, really happy to see the kind of curatorial work and like passionate film going that I had encountered when I used to live in New York, and had always kind of wanted to find that world out here. And, you know, he and I started talking about the different ways that we felt like hyper-independent films were not necessarily able to find their footing in LA, and how frustrating that could be. And so that was sort of, that conversation was sort of the birth of this festival.
Hmm. So how does it differ from what was once the Los Angeles Film Festival? Because that unfortunately ceased to exist, but was also showcasing interesting independent films.
Absolutely. I mean, that festival to us is one of the places we look when we're looking for inspiration. I screened a couple shorts there when I was just starting out, really admire what they were doing. The thing that's different for us is that that festival really was focused on filmmakers and a little bit more of a marketplace, trying to help filmmakers meet other filmmakers and talk about filmmaking. Whereas I think our film festival is really trying to focus on film goers and talk about film appreciation.
And you're screening most of the films on the east side of Los Angeles?
Yeah. So the festival is taking place at three venues that are all located on the east side. So we have Vidiot's, which is now at the Eagle Theater in Eagle Rock. We have 2220 Arts and Archives, which used to be the Bootleg Theater, which was a live music venue and has now become this sort of interdisciplinary space for arts, music, poetry, film, what have you. And the third venue is a new space called Now Instant Image Hall, which is a sort of boutique micro cinema in Chinatown that tends to show a lot of art and experimental cinema. And for us, it was really important to help audiences beat the traffic and for people to, you know, be able to spend a day, whether they want to see, you know, two or three movies at one venue or see one at 2220 and pop over to our shorts program and Now Instant. We wanted to make it easier for people to not have to travel too far, which, you know, of course, is the cliche of LA is that, and also, you know, these were all venues that to us have really carved out niches for themselves in terms of this sort of increasingly eclectic and exciting new landscape.
Well, really the best of luck to you. I hope it succeeds. I'm really excited about it, and I'm happy that you're doing this. So yay.
Thank you so
Thank
much.
Thank you. Yeah. Yay, Thank you very you. Much.
My pleasure. That's Sarah Winshaw and Micah Gottlieb, organizers of the new Los Angeles Festival of Movies. It runs tomorrow through Sunday, and you can find out more information at their website, lafestivalofmovies.org. Coming up, we meet a young British singer influenced by Amy Winehouse. Lola Young is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. That's Wish You Were Dead by the British singer-songwriter Lola Young, a rising pop star in the London music scene, and she is just 23 years old. Her passion for music was developed at the Brit School. That's a performing arts high school in London where Adele, Amy Winehouse, Imogen Heap, and many other artists studied as well. Her signature has become her searingly honest lyrics, at times self-deprecating, with tons of attitude. She first put out music back in 2019, when she was just a teenager, with her intro EP. I'm too pessimistic to move forward, but I'm too optimistic to stay. That's The Man, one of her first songs. She's out with a new album now called My Mind Wanders and Sometimes Leaves Completely. She's performing in Los Angeles this weekend at the Terragram Ballroom on Saturday and at the Echo on Sunday. And Lola Young joins me now. Welcome.
Hey.
Hey. Well, you have such a rich, throaty voice. Were you trained? Was your voice trained, or is this all you natural singing?
I did train quite a bit, like early in my life, and like did a lot of like vocal lessons and coaching, but I think a lot of it I think is pretty much, I'm pretty self-taught when it comes to my voice, but you know, a couple lessons here and there for sure.
Yeah, you're self-taught. So when did you first start singing? How old were you?
Well, I've been singing for as long as I can really remember, if I'm honest. It's been a very long time since I've been making music and writing and all of the above. So, yeah.
So, like, when you were a little kid, you would sing around the house, things like that?
Yeah, exactly. I've always been super singy and just, like, singing loads and, like, yeah, and music's been a massive part of my life since I've been very little. So, it's very important to me.
And did you grow up in a musical family?
Yeah, I would say so. My mom like is very involved in music. My stepdad's a bass player. There's a lot of like music in and around my family and my life. I think I was, you know, as a little kid, I was always just in my room with my guitar, like proper jamming away, like practicing and writing songs. It's always been a massive part of my whole life and my existence, really. Yeah.
Mm. So, what is it about music in particular that it seems like you can't live without? Like, what does it do for you?
It's a massive outlet for me. It's like something that I physically can't live without, because it's like my only form of understanding something when I don't actually understand it myself quite yet. It's a way of like me going into my head and like dissecting something or trying to figure something out through, you know, music's one of the most beautiful art forms in my opinion. Obviously I'm biased, but It's like, it's such a gorgeous way of expressing yourself through words, through lyrics, through melody, like, and it's something that I don't think I could live without, because it's so ingrained in who I am now. And also, you know, obviously I'm living off of music, but it's also something that I so heavily passionate about, because of the fact that I need to really understand who I am, like, and what I go through my outlet, which is music.
And so let's hear a little bit more of your music. And this one is called, this track is called Don't Hate Me. I think that I love you, but it's hard just to be around you. You said I'm gonna be a big star. Don't lie to my face. It's cool if you don't wanna hang and get loose. But my mom wants me back at like 20 to 2. And babe, That's the song Don't Hate Me by my guest, British singer Lola Young. Who are you talking about there?
So this song that's actually written about a bunch of different, well, it was, you know, when I write, it kind of sometimes is that I'm taking inspiration from different situations that I've had. So that song is about a lot of different people, really. And just realizing that some people aren't really what they're cracked up to be, you know, and like, it's a shame, but also there's a lot of like self, when you spoke about like, the self-deprecating thing, like there's some self-deprecating, you know, you said I'm going to be a big star, don't lie to my face, those kind of things as well. So it's about a bunch of different things for me.
So who said that you're going to be a big star and you're calling them out?
I love ex-boyfriends, ex-partners, ex-friends kind of like hate on what I'm, my dreams and my passion, and like that was my way of going like, actually screw you, I can do this kind of thing. But also it's like funny in a sense because it's almost like I'm kind of agreeing with them.
But you kind of are a star, you're on your way already.
A little bit. I'd like to think so. I'd like to hope so, you know.
Do you envision yourself as becoming a really big pop star?
I think it's interesting because I do get asked this question sometimes, and sometimes I like to kind of be like, oh no, like modest and stuff. But I do, this is my dream, you know, this is something that I've always wanted to achieve. And I, of course, would love to be super successful, but the fame isn't really my priority. It's more just about like ensuring that my music gets heard to the most far-reached audience as possible. You know, that's all I care about, really.
Yeah, yeah. Is there someone in particular that you look to as a model for this or how you would like your career to look?
I think there's like a lot of different artists that I look at their career and I think they've had an incredible career. Obviously, I'm a massive fan of artists like SZA, Frank Ocean, and those artists are just like, keep managed to retain their enigma, their authenticity, and just themselves, you know, throughout this like very busy journey, which is the music mm-hmm. industry. But I think that, it really just, mine can look completely different, you know. It's just like, it's about the way that I want my career to go.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm sure you've heard the comparison many times to Adele and Amy Winehouse, right?
Yeah.
How do you feel about those comparisons?
I think it's obviously I'm super, like, completely complimented and, like, feel very, very flattered that someone would compare me to two of the probably most incredible singers and artists that have ever lived. I think as I progress in my career and as things continue, I think there'll be a lot of, you know, I'm lonely, I'm not Amy, I'm not Adele, that's very clear. But I think it's just incredible to be recognized as a singer that has a strong voice, I guess.
Right. And also that you went to the same school as they. So what is it about this school that turns out so many great singers?
I think the Brit School is a great school for many different reasons, but it's you know, it's still a school. It's a lot of people think that it's like this like crazy kind of people like fame kind of dancing on chairs. It's still very much a school, and it's a school in like a small area in South East London. But I think the beauty of it is that there's a lot of people who get to kind of be exactly who they want to be, you know, and like mm-hmm. you don't get told you have to try and mold in a certain way or be a certain way, like you can just be. And there's a lot of like diversity in terms of like everything when it comes to the British school. So that's why I think it you know, creates so many incredible people who leave and end up doing a lot of work in the industry.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with the British singer-songwriter Lola Young, a new pop star out of England. She's performing two shows this weekend here in Los Angeles. Let's hear a little bit more music and then we can talk some more. This song is called Intrusive Thoughts.
Hey there, intrusive thoughts, you don't make sense at all. Wish you would go away with some paracetamol. Hey there, intrusive thoughts, maybe I'm wired all strange. All these intrusive thoughts, don't know what's real or not. They scream inside my head, wish I could kill the Lord. I've got intrusive thoughts, maybe I'm wired all strange. Thank you.
That's the song Intrusive Thoughts by my guest Lola Young. Do you want to talk about that, about what you're talking about there in that song?
Yeah, I don't mind. I suffer from a mental health condition, which I'm going to depth about as well on my Instagram if you want to look at that. But my mental health condition is one of the symptoms are intrusive thoughts. And it's a song about that, really, about my disorder, about going through the motions with having like really intense, insane intrusive thoughts and just being like wanting to shut them up and wanting them to go away. And then that experience and like how that makes me, how they make, you know, it's painful, it's difficult. It's a very, acute kind of like disorder. So it acts in very weird ways. But yeah.
So you will sometimes have these thoughts come into your head that you don't want, the intrusive thoughts. And that's part of the mental illness?
Exactly, yes. And I think it's a hard thing to live with, you know, and it's a hard thing to have, but it's something that I've grown to accept, which is why at the end of that song there's like a bit of like self-acceptance and just accepting the fact that I have this disorder and knowing that it's not always that bad, it's going to be okay, and there's always light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah, and are the voices mainly, are they always negative, or are they also positive?
I mean, the intrusive thoughts, they would, you know, they're always pretty negative, which is a shame.
They are.
I wish I had intrusive positive thoughts, but no, they're always pretty negative and hard. But that's why I decided to have a form of self-acceptance lyric at the end there.
And when did you first notice them? How old were you?
Well, I was diagnosed with my disorder when I was 17. And so I went through a whole whirlwind of emotions and bad experiences since then. So, yeah, it's been hard, you know, on medication, et cetera. So, but yeah, it's getting better for sure.
The medication helps?
Yeah, the medication massively helps me. I mean, I know this is a bit of a controversial topic, but for me, medication really helps and helps me kind of like get my day-to-day life, really.
Yeah. And does it affect how you think about music and how you write music?
Yes, it does. It's definitely, you know, when I'm in an elated state, I love to write a lot of music and be creative. But, you know, when I go through my little low periods, I can also feel quite isolated. So it affects my career, but I think it in a weird way can also affect my creative output towards in music. Yeah,
so it can help you with writing songs and coming up with melodies and things like that.
Yeah.
So what is it like being on stage then? Does that help too? Does it feel cathartic in some way?
Well, being on stage in general is amazing. I love the feeling. It's very, you know, very electric feeling. And it's a beautiful thing to be on stage, you know, like just performing to people who love your music and care about your music. And yeah.
All right. Lola Young, her project is called My Mind Wanders and Sometimes Leaps Completely. She's performing at the Terragram Ballroom this Saturday and also at the Echo on Sunday. Thanks for joining us.
Who's Art? I know I'm stressed. The truth's heavy in my chest. When you're making love, you wanna make with us.
Tomorrow on Press Play, do not miss my conversation with Good Foods' Evan Kleinman. She just returned from Arizona where she was exploring flour tortillas. Yes, she was. And she'll stop by with a story about an underappreciated ingredient in those tortillas, Sonora white wheat. I know. It sounds detailed, but believe me, you'll be interested. That's our show tomorrow. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening today, and I'll see you back here again tomorrow. I hate when you call her up just to talk about your little job, and I hate when you make amends as if you've done absolutely nothing, and I'm sorry if I'm holding on too tight. I know I'm not that sweet, but do I ever